E2.
Number 24A.
I was telling about the story of Philemon and how Paul would write a letter to Philemon and give it to Onesimus to bring it home to his master. So you can see what Onesimus must have felt to go home where he ran away and perhaps has pinched and dropped his master with money and think, golly, he has the right to beat me up. And so Paul showed Philemon that he should set Onesimus free. What happened, we do not know. We only know the letter. But the interesting thing is that at this point of science, that Paul would not ask Onesimus to go home and be a better slave. But at the point of science, he would set him free and would show that each one, for us now, would show that each one, no matter what his past is, no matter what he has done, that fundamentally he is the idea of God, and that he has to recognize him not as being the slave of any wrong impulsion, of any wrong traits of character and things like that, but that fundamentally man is free. In other words, that we should set everyone free. I wish we could do that. Always to approach everyone and say, and have that inward conviction, he's free. He's the idea of God. There is nothing else but the idea of God. Not even we ask him to improve and to be better or to pay back his debts, to be sorry for what he has been doing, to recompense for what he has been doing. But every time just to approach anyone and say, you are free, you are a whole man. And that is the science of man. And at the point of Philemon, we can really claim it, and that transforms the situation. We come to Hebrew, and nobody really knows who wrote Hebrew. They have never found out. Some say it may have been Paul, others say it hasn't been Paul. Hebrew is a terrific epistle, quite terrific. And I think there is in the whole Bible no book that is laid out with such ordered structure, substructure, substructure, never deviating from that structure, right from one sentence to the other. It's a book that first of all has levels in it, starting right out with the first chapter on the high level of divine science, showing how Jesus sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high, and that he was set above the angels, above thoughts. And then comes the main body of the message, and then the last chapter, bringing the whole subject right down to the human application. But the main body that goes through it is a terrific presentation of the calculus. It shows Word, Christ, Christianity, and science, reflected through the Word, Christ, Christianity, and science, and each time again reflected as Word, Christ, Christianity, and science. So that it is a very fine structure of the calculus. For what purpose did he write the calculus? I just pinpoint those four big sites of the city that he is showing in the Word, first, that there is a way of salvation. You see, I said when we come to the last column, it's all about the scientific way of salvation. Here at Hebrew, he shows really first that there is now a way of salvation. then the second part, the Christ, is showing that there is a new high priest now, namely Christ. No more a person, but the Christ is the new high priest. And then third, that there is a sanctuary, which is a symbol of the realm of being, and that we have to right to enter as the high priest into the sanctuary. Whereas in the Old Testament, only the high priest as a person once a year was able to enter the holiest of holies. And he right opens the gates and shows that each one is the high priest and is entering the sanctuary, and that there is a sanctuary. And fourth, he shows, and that is the way to perfection. There is right now a state of perfection to be seen. So he has those four big sides for showing us how to find the day of rest. And you know how Hebrew shows that there is still a day of rest preserved for the people of God towards the end of the gospel, of the epistle. And so he shows in a minutely detailed way, it's terrific, how we, each one of us, has now before him, first the word, a way of salvation, that he himself is the high priest, that he himself enters the sanctuary of holiness, and what he finds there is that perfection is a present state of consciousness and of being. These are the main traits in there. And then he subdivides those four into four, and each one again into four, just giving a minute program, so to say, or steering mechanism, which says, now make this step, and then that little step, and then you come again somewhere to a platform, then you make a new step, and that is a little step to get there. And it is as if we would feel that here is a platform, a program, which shows us exactly how to culture consciousness in order to come to the day of rest. So what you can see here again is science from the point of view of Christianity, namely by showing that there is a science of man, and that principle of man operates in man, and that, now Christianity, that by abiding steadfastly in that way he showed, in that way of salvation, by abiding there steadfastly, he actually arrives at the day of rest. He gains a victory. He actually arrives at the day of rest. So he triumphs over the world and gets to the day of rest. If we take Jude as the last one, he's not well known, Jude, and all what is usually cited about Jude is the last part of his letter, where he makes that terrific statement, really, that man is unfailingly held in God, giving, so to say, a sense that man has never fallen away from God, that he has always been in God and is unfailingly held in God. And can you see the pinnacle? Though he is not a well-known writer, he's not cited very often, he doesn't give long stories and so on, but he presents one big point, and that point is really that which makes him the last cornerstone in the matrix, where we arrive at the point that we see that in the science of man, principle operates as the idea of man, and that idea is never has never fallen away from God, cannot fall away from God. It is something, as Mrs. Eddy would say, man can no more sin, be sick, or die. So that we have the proof of that by our very existence, that man is unfailingly held in principle. An idea can never leave its principle. Can you see again how very close we come when we compare this 16th epistle with the 16th chapter in the textbook, where again we could see that nothing is going on but the idea, and never has anything going on but the idea of principle. So let's run quickly through that last column again and just see what do these epistles show. They show really that the science of man is really the way of salvation. In the pastoral epistles, he first presents that science of man and says to Titus and Timothy, accept that principle, and then you will be an example for everybody's salvation. In Philemon, he says, go and set everyone free. Transform everyone. We said that the Christ horizontal says that by claiming the true idea, a transformation takes place. And so in Philemon, he shows, yes, you are not a slave, and no matter if you have been robbing your master, fundamentally, you are free. He said something very nice, I can't quite quote now off cuff, that he said, he writes to Philemon and says, I send you my son, Onesimus, whom I have borne, something like that, in my chains, in the prison. And he says, I have borne him, I have given birth to the new idea, the free idea, not to the mortal. It is as if he would have seen something of scientific obstetrics, that if we really detach mortal thoughts from all material conceptions, that then the idea is brought forth safe and free, and that that idea has not a single element of error. Once he has seen that Onesimus is transformed from a mortal to the free idea of the scientific man, then Hebrew comes along and says, and you see, this would be the method through which you find your day of rest. And you can overcome the world. You can sit down on the throne at the right hand of the majesty on high, and from there you can see that you have overcome the world, not only that there is a way of salvation, but that you are the high priest, that you are reigning in the sanctuary, and that you are in the realm of perfection right now. And so you have overcome the world. And having overcome the world, Jude began to see that man never left God, never has been going to the world and never had to come back from the world, but that man is unfailingly held in God. Do you feel why it is perhaps a much greater impact on our lives to see the matrix form in our words than to read various verses in the epistles? You can see that the matrix is that method that helps us to see, so to say, in one view, here in one view, the Christianity matrix with those 16 boxes, the whole problem of manhood. What is man? What is man's relationship to Word, Christ, Christianity, and science? And how does Word, Christ, Christianity, and science affect man or the mortal? And in one view, you feel you find the answer to the whole problem of manhood, whereas if we read the Bible linearly, and there are some 100 pages, we may be very much touched by various sentences and verses. They help us, they comfort us, but actually the whole problem of being that we have to solve, we should first have an overall view of it, so that when we go to one of those 16 epistles, that we know where to place it, what kind of specific problem out of the whole problem of being is being dealt with, and then we see its place value much better. But just to go over this matrix as I have done within an hour or so, and see those place values, I'm quite sure that this is a terrific help. And actually, in the measure as one sits down and just tries to go through those 4x4, and just tries more and more to feel the identity of each of those points of intersection, so that each one becomes very much differentiated from all the others. It is actually that clear-cut differentiation from one in comparison with the other that makes that whole mosaic, so to say, have a true form and be a real help. And in order to do that, I don't see any other way than to be quiet within oneself and try to go through them, not in the old way of thinking, but in that categorical way of thinking. To think in categories, horizontal, vertical, in point of intersection. That's all that is needed. Can you see, it's an easy way of thinking, because it doesn't demand anything of memorizing, anything like that is demanded. It always only demands that one is aware of, first, it is all about Christianity here, that's one factor. Second factor, what is the vertical I'm thinking about? And the third factor, what is the horizontal? And with three categories in one's consciousness and keeping those pure, you have the point of intersection, you have the whole problem stated. And you have stated it not only in New Testament wise, but in our experience, in our life wise. We live it, we are it. Those problems are our problems. I don't think there is one problem I touched in those 16 epistles where not each one could say to himself, yes, that's something I have to work out, that's something that I have to see, that is something that applies to me. Yes, well, that would be the Christianity matrix. So what we have been doing up to now was really that we were trying to take as the historical development unfolded, to take those matrices, and we could see that the big matrices which we encountered up to this point, not that they are the only matrices, that we encountered John Dorley's matrix as a 4x4 matrix, and had a kind of feeling that it could be the word matrix, but we were not quite sure, and we leave it at that, with that question mark. And then we had the science and health matrix as a Christian Science matrix, then the prophet matrix as the Christ matrix, now the epistles as the Christianity matrix. So we have, so to say, 4x16 point of intersections, and so we could reduce those four important matrices still further, and little by little we would gain in that reductional sense a much deeper insight and impression and tonality of those big four categories called Word, Christ, Christianity and science. How can we do that if we stick to the scientific method and build, so to say, on our findings? Then what we can do is actually that we would say, now, how do the I indices, which we had in those four matrices, how do they compare to each other? The other way around. How are they differentiated from each other? Can we now see that just by saying word, we are much too indefinite, that it can mean too many things, and that we had to differentiate, say, the word in the verticals and the Christ in the verticals? And so you can see what we could do. We could now take those four sheets which you have on those four matrices, which you have on separate sheets and loose leaf, and take always the index I and transfer our findings of the index I into a new composed matrix, something like this. We could take now a matrix sheet and do the following. And I would like you to be now a bit concentrated, and so that we don't lose too much time. Could you just take now those four matrices which you have in front of you, and then we would just transfer our findings. Now, for instance, if you take John Dolly's matrix, which with a question mark we felt could be the word matrix, and take from that matrix the I index, and you put the findings in your columns, then vertically here you would have in the word God's self-declaration, then the Christ idea. In Christianity, God's infinite self-reflection, and in science, God's self-interpretation. Now, take the Christ matrix from the Minor Prophets, and take again the I index. And what you get there in the I index is, and I say it first quickly, and then afterwards I go back and you can write it down. You have there, can you see where you are? You have there the monopotency of God, good, and then the Christ likeness, and then the self-conservation of the idea, and then the operation of the idea in its principle. Can you read that? All right, now you can write it down. Now, you take the Christianity matrix, which either you have on your sheet or in the book, and you take the I index. You have it in front of you. Do you see where I am? And I read it first. Don't write it, so that you know where I am, and then I give you time to write it down. It's there where we had in the Christianity matrix. The word was the grace of God, then the glory of Christ in Christ, then in Christianity the idea of man's perfection, and in science the science of man. Can you see that? Okay. Now, take the matrix we made on science and health, on the structure of science and health. There the I index, which we have found out after we have corrected it, read, the word was the revelation of God's nature. Then the Christ was the translation of God to idea. Christianity was the realm of ideas, and science was principle and idea is one. Now, do you see what we have done? We have asked ourselves, here we have four matrices. They are all matrices of the 4x4 concept. And instead of always saying in those four matrices just word, Christ, Christianity and science, we say, but each matrix must have a different tonality in it. And so we tried in those four matrices to define which tone of the word, which tone of the Christ, which tone of Christianity, and which tone of science is here under consideration. And now we take the findings and put them into a matrix where the I is actually now the whole word, the whole Christ, the whole Christianity, and the whole science. And the J is the matrix from which we have taken them, you see? Horizontally, this is the first the word matrix, that would be John Dolly's matrix. The Christ matrix would be from the minor prophets. The Christianity matrix would be from the epistles. And the science matrix horizontally from the structure of the textbook. And when we have that, we can now see how nicely differentiated those four are and how they show again the evolution within itself. If we take the word here now vertically, we have here the absolute word and shown through four phases. And we can see that there is a flow in it. That the word starts, so to say, with the self-declaration in the word. God declaring himself what he is. Then going further down to the Christ, you begin to see that this self-declaration of God says, and I have a power. I am the only power at work, and I am the only power of good. I am only good. And again, a step further, you can see because we have the monopotency of good, that God, that word, must be a God of grace. He only gives good, never hates, never withdraws anything or withholds anything, that he is that it is a God of grace, and that finally we begin to see that that God can be understood in science because he reveals himself as what he is. And we have in science the revelation of God's nature to man as what he is.